This episode is brought to you in part by UC Irvine's Executive Master's Program for Human-Computer Interaction and Design. As a user experience professional, UCI's hybrid program will allow you to maintain your job while pursuing the master's degree that will propel your career forward. Stay tuned to learn more about this exciting program.
Do you want us to just design on a three cappuccino epiphany? Or do you want us to have evidence-driven decision-making and do the research? You can make the choice how much you're willing to risk. You know, your career, all of our jobs, you know, it's cool. Go ahead. What do you want to do? You know, when you put it that way, they're like, well, of course I'll do the research.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 67. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. Today, I had the great privilege of speaking to Dr. John Whalen. In this compelling and thought-provoking episode, we discuss the ever-important topic of designing for how people think. We discuss things like language, for example, making sure we have clarity of industry jargon, since we need to understand where people are to get them where we want them to go. We also talk about emotion. No matter how hard some of us may try to dismiss it, this stuff is emotional, and we need to tap into that truth to truly empathize and better serve our users. We also talk about wayfinding. We answer the all-important question of why does it seem like only younger folks can understand how to use Snapchat, and much, much more. John's a great storyteller and tells many practical and fun stories that guide us into the psychology of designing for how people think. Before we get to the episode, I want to tell you that John has generously sent me a few of his books to give away to you. And so be sure to stay tuned through the end of the episode to learn how you can win a free copy of John's brand new book. Thanks so much for being here, dear Defender, and please enjoy this insightful episode. Today I have with me John Whalen, and John is the founder, I should say Dr. John. He is the founder and lead of Psychological Insights and Innovation at Brilliant Experience. He's an international speaker and author of the recently published book, Designing for How People Think. It's an O'Reilly published book as well, and the subtitle is Using Brain Science to Build Better Products. It's a great book, and we're going to talk all about it today. He also helps businesses use psychological research to strategically position their products, services, and marketing. As I mentioned, he has a PhD in cognitive science and 15-plus years of experience working in user research and product design with Fortune 500 companies and design agencies. Fun facts about John is he's camped north of the Arctic Circle on 12 feet of ice. Brr. He's a green-eyed, left-handed psychology PhD, making him, statistically at least, one in a million. So welcome to User Defenders. John, I just want to say I'm super excited to have you on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, it's an honor to be on User Defenders. It's quite a show. So I appreciate everything you've done over the years. So thank you.
Oh, that means a lot, man. Thank you. So your new book, you wrote a book, and I have really enjoyed reading this book. It's super enlightening. I have my more recent study of behavioral science, and especially as it relates to design. So like, I feel like this book was totally for me, and I know it's for a lot of other people too, but I just really, I felt a connection with it, and I learned a ton. Thanks for writing this book, John.
Sure. Well, you know, it takes some work. I won't lie, but...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, actually, I don't know if I ever told you the story of how I got to writing this. I was doing a South by Southwest talk, which was an honor as well. And, you know, I had the head of innovation from Lufthansa and all these cool people come up to me and they said, wow, this psychology stuff, we should totally have that in design and innovation. And I love what you're doing. And boy, I wish I was a psychology PhD too, so I could do it. Anyway, see you later, bye. And I was like, no, wait, you can too. And so, you know, my message about the interest in psychology was there, but how to actually use it in your own work wasn't as much as I would hope in a short, you know, South by Southwest talk. So really the goal with this was to say that, yes, you don't need to be a psychology PhD and that there are lots of ways you can apply this practically every day. So absolutely. I'm glad that you had the interest too.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really kind of nascent in our field. The marriage of psychology and design. It really seems, even though like design, like if you look from the very beginning of time, design has always been psychological. It's always been like marketing is highly psychological, right? Like there's always been like that existence, but I don't think the dots really connected as far as UX goes until more recent years. Like, do you know, like, how did this happen? How did we get here? What was sort of the origin story of this? Like,
interesting.
And I'm just kind of throwing that out at you.
No.
This conversation is totally unscripted, Defenders. I have a couple questions here, but we're just kind of going off the cuff. So I'm surprising John with all sorts of questions already.
Yeah, that's great. So first of all, I'd say that, there are a couple things that I think really helped us, think this way a little more. And one was, just literally the introduction of the iPhone made people realize, wow, how valuable it is to have good product design that's actually really intuitive or more intuitive than what we had before. And also, I feel like, a shout out to the Norman and Nielsen group, and they, for a long time, we're talking about this thing called usability. And, even before that, the sort of computer interface design kind of work that was, there's a lot of that that goes on in like the military for how do you get like group dynamics to work. But translating into what we use every day, is something different. And I think that I would argue that those two groups were really instrumental in making that change. And actually, to your point, too, about designers, the way I introduced it in the book, actually, and I think I really believe, too, thankfully, is that there are many things that great designers do, and I think they do it intuitively. They've learned over time. They just kind of know. But there are other things that I want to make sure they're aware of. First of all, just be aware of what you're doing to make a conscious decision about it. And secondly, there are pieces of psychology that are so innate and that you don't have. So, for example, wherever you're looking right now, you're looking at some object and you just see it. And you're not saying to yourself, I wonder where the light and dark is. I wonder if those things together make a line. I wonder if that makes three dimensions. It just kind of happens. And so I felt like one of the things I wanted to share with designers were there are many intuitions they had, and we can try to solidify those, but also really get at this idea that there are so many things that your audience can't verbalize because they don't even know they're doing it. It's implicit to their life. And so we can look at behavior and kind of catch some of those things. So it was really even for designers that probably are doing a lot of what I would ask them to do to let them know why they were doing that all these years and think about it just in a little more systematically that way.
That's fascinating. I think one of the really neat things ever since I really started diving a lot more into psychology and how the brain works is that whenever something's happening, like in an interaction, for example, like when I'm talking to somebody and maybe they do something or say something, or maybe their body language, like I'm like understanding all of these things now. Like I understand why they're doing that or saying that. I understand why I'm reacting a certain way or why, for example, like in negotiations, like the whole principle of anchoring, which our wonderful mentor, Dr. Daniel Kahneman, brought us to in Thinking Fast and Slow, right? I love that book, by the way, and I loved how you cited it several times in your book as an inspiration. So bringing us into your book and how we can use psychology to become better designers. Like I want to jump into sort of the six minds of experience. Is this your book is really centered around that principle. And I learned a lot about what those mean and how they relate to design. When you read those on the surface without the context that you provide, you might just go like, well, what does this mean? Like, how does this relate to a product? You do such a great job of explaining that in your book. But I want to just kind of ask you, what are the six minds of experience? And why are they important to consider in the design process?
Yeah, so first of all, shout out to anyone who has a neuropsychological background or cognitive science, and I apologize in advance. What I did is I tried to make this so that it was, really something you could connect to without having perfectly tied to, say, brain science and stuff. But I wanted to make it so designers could really get it. So the six, what I tried to say is this big notion of the book is that when we have any experience, like think about the best concert you went to recently. And, in truth, there are all kinds of pieces to that. The like lights, who you were with, what your emotion was, what your recollection was of the last time you went to a band like this. And, there are all kinds of pieces. And so those six minds what I argue is that truly a brilliant experience, the name of my company, is not a singular experience, but it's actually a sort of multidimensional and multimodal. And so what I argue is that you have obviously a vision and intention component. So what draws your attention? What are you looking at? You've got a component of navigating around to get to where you need to be, whether it's real or virtual space. You've got the words that you might use, both you as the designer and you as the receiver. You've got ultimately decisions and things you're trying to decide on that you're doing. You've got all these emotions that are tied to, you know, is this the car I deserve? You know, all these kind of emotional pieces that are attached to any decisions you make. And then all your memories. So basically like what you're expecting, you know, hanging out in a car dealership to be like, as an example. And so really those are the six, that there's sort of vision, wayfinding, so moving around in space, language, decision-making, emotion, and memory. And together, I would argue that those are some of the biggest pieces to what you experience as a singular experience.
And I know you've done a lot of research, and I really love the emphasis on contextual inquiries in the book and applying these six minds principles. Do you have like an impactful story that you can tell us of something that you've observed either in research or the success of a product using kind of these principles and like a psychology based approach in your design process?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Let me tell you a silly story that's an example, but I promise to get us to the design side too. I have a small business owner, so I talk to my insurance agent who, you know, does sort of a yearly review of are you covered in the right ways. And he was like, how's your plup? And, you know, I instinctively like turned my hips and was like, you know, how dare you think about my plup? You know, and it turns out that's an umbrella policy for your insurance, right? And I had no idea. And I was like, you know, don't look at my plup. That's none of your business. But it was an excellent example of like, well, that's language that's totally normal to him. And to me, it's like Greek. And you know, I'm like looking at my body for where's a plup and, you know, and is it out of place? And, you know, So anyway, that's a good example of, you know, a complete disconnect, right? Where, you know, if he designed it around this PLUP and didn't call it an umbrella policy, I would have no clue. And so, so that's language. That's, you know, one of those pieces. And then you can see the emotion, you know, immediately I was like completely not thinking about what he wanted me to and distracted and all those kind of things. So, you know, matching people where they are is one of the things I think is so important. Similar to that with language, we were working with the folks at NIH.gov, we helped design. And a piece of that is the all the listings of things that could go wrong with you. And, you know, a lot of those are very serious. And it turns out that, you know, we as humans tend to call them like, you know, a mini stroke and not a transient ischemic attack. And so, you know, no one could find things on that site because they were using the sort of, you know, common folksonomy kind of names. And so what we did is we actually did pair the actual thing like a transient ischemic attack to mini stroke so that people could find things and connect the dots. And you know, the neurologists in that example hated it because they're like, that's not accurate, there is no such thing as a mini stroke. Agreed, but we have to meet people where they are in order to get them to where we want them to be. So I think that in many cases there's a translation between what the entity or internal group wants and what the, you know, mere mortal, you know, is thinking about. And, you know, you mentioned buying a car. In those kind of cases too, there's so many situations where you're like, well, I want big drink holders and I want it to go 0-60 in 3 seconds. And it's like, okay, well, you know, we're going to pick one of those. We're not going to pick two.
Unless you can afford a Tesla.
That's right. I haven't checked out the drink holders. I'll have to think about that. But my attention was not drawn there when I was sitting at one. So it's really, you know, I think this comes true almost every time, whether you're, and the other thing I was going to say is I very much want all of you who are reading this and thinking about psychology, you know, to not only apply it to our end designs that we're doing, but when we're selling this to our senior executives and their boss's boss, you know, what are they thinking about? You know, I often ask people, well, what's your boss's boss's bonus on. Like it's probably high enough up that it's like publicly available information. And you know, most of the time they have no idea. And I'm like, well, if you design something that makes this guy be able to hit, or woman be able to hand this to that boss, and you know, they're hitting their number, wouldn't that they be more receptive to that? And you know, we all know it, but we don't think like that. And so I want us to turn it both ways. And so I argue that 40% of what I do is, you know, finding out what an audience or for a product or service really need, and you know, coming up with ideas for that. And 60% is understanding the organization, so we don't make shelfware, we make something that really comes to life. I think it's totally applicable, and it makes your even just satisfaction of doing your job so much better by having be listened to, because you present it in a way that resonates with them.
Next time I go into, I'm shopping for insurance right now. Next time I go into the insurance agency, I'm going to ask him how much it would cost to insure my plup.
<That's it. laughs> What sort of plup do you think I should have? Yeah. Do you think I have the plup I deserve? Yeah.
That's awesome. You know, another acronym too is GOOB. It's mm-hmm. like, Goob, what the heck? Why are you talking about my goob?
That's right.
You know, like if I have a booger hanging out of my nose or something, it's like, oh, no, we're get out of the building, getting Absolutely. Out of the building. Oh, okay. So it's like, that's another sort of reinforcement of the principle you mentioned of language. Mm-hmm. As you said, there's so many acronyms. Like when we go into a new workplace, like I almost feel like that in every company that has more than 10 acronyms, which most do, like I feel like there should be a one sheet, and if they can't fit all the acronyms on one sheet, then they need to take some away.
Nice.
And or just pass those out in the onboarding. Like, here's a sheet of our acronyms. When you know, read this over, study this, and when you hear this, this is what we mean. Like, wouldn't that be helpful?
Absolutely. Yeah, I actually had one group. I it was only because one of the junior people kept writing it down themselves that they wound up having something like that. But I've been with dozens and dozens of companies that I've worked with, and only one has given me that sheet. And yeah, that would be awesome.
Wow. Memory. All of these things, like even just as we're talking, like they're totally reinforced by psychology and by psychological laws. Like Miller's Law tells us that if we're lucky, we can retain 7 ± 2 pieces of information in our working memory. And that is totally tied into user interface. It's tied into how much content we have on a screen. And I'll be honest with you, like I strongly believe the longer we live with our smartphones, that number is going down. Because we rely so much on these computers in our pockets, we don't have to memorize anything anymore. Can you even tell me 3 phone numbers that are in your contact list right now, John? Do you have three phone numbers memorized in your contact?
I have phone numbers that no longer exist anymore. That you know, when I was a kid, my like home phone number, but
sure.
You know, that home has been knocked down and there's something else in its place. So, yeah, times have changed. So no, not 3 useful numbers. No. Yeah. It's interesting. And, you know, you mentioned Miller, you know, Miller's classic study from the '50s, and it turns out that actually in vision, if you're trying to keep track of things, you can only keep track of 3 or 4 things in vision, unlike holding whatever in working memory as a more like sound or representational based. And, you know, but the interesting thing about the Miller one that you're talking about is you can remember, and we keep saying things, and we're very like, you know, it's a terrible word if you're a lawyer, right? What's that thing? And so, and the point is that it's like sort of entities or ideas. So if I gave you 7, you know, characters, so I give you, you know, K, L, M, D, F, Q, R, you know, you're trying really hard. You can probably remember those. I'm not going to ask you to do them backwards or it won't work. But I could probably give you, you know, FBI, CIA, NHL, NBA, and so on. And you could remember 7 of those. And then, and that's 21 letters. And so the point is that you can remember about 7 things. So if you get the right groupings and you know, that you can put together, you can be quite powerful that way. So I don't think we've totally lost it yet. You're right that we don't memorize things like we used to, but the things that we do remember, and in terms of memory, you know, we always think of the example that you gave of the sort of working memory. And if any of you are not old enough, I want you to go back to the old Saturday Night Lives there's one called Mr. Short-Term Memory. And so, you know, and it is true. Actually, we worked with in, you know, stroke patients and other folks where you can tell them a joke you can leave the room, shut the door, and you bang it just a little bit so it kind of refreshes their memory. You walk in, you say, "Hi, I'm John." "Oh, really? Oh, it's nice to meet you, John." And they would like no idea you were in there. And you can tell them the same joke that you know they think is funny. And they're like, "Oh, that is hilarious." And so anyway, it is true that, you know, you really need that working memory. But, you know, I want you to think of memory in terms of like all your expectations in the world. And you can call them stereotypes or biases or lots of things. But you know, I give the example in the book because it happened in real life. I was like, "Hey, you know, do you want to meet up? We had a hard day at work. Let's meet up for happy hour." And, you know, I was thinking of like, you know, this place that, you know, maybe, I don't know, there's a little spray paint on the walls and, you know, you get yourself a beer and we're good. And, you know, the person I was with was thinking of, you know, a place that had like, you know, neon under the counter that sort of glows and drinks with umbrellas that have like, you know, black, dry ice, you know, foam coming out of them. And it's like all very swanky. And, you know, both of us were thinking of the concept happy hour, but we had hugely different expectations. You know, in one place, you know, they wouldn't know what a credit card is and you would expect to get, you know, wet with beer. And the other one, you know, is an entirely different circumstance. And so really, what is that expectation that people have about how things are going down? And, you know, even a restaurant is a great example where, there's a restaurant on K Street in Washington, D.C., where you go, you walk in, and there are people sitting and eating, but there's nobody there. And you're like, "Oh, okay. Well, there are people eating. They must have got their food from somewhere." And so, you see a tablet off to the right, and you're like, "Oh, well, you know, maybe that's where I order. I've seen, you know, tablets elsewhere to order. You know, it's kind of like a lunchy kind of place, not too fancy." So, you know, I did that. And I was like, "Oh, I wonder." And, you know, you got to pay right there, too. And you're like, "Okay, well, I wonder when I'm going to see a human." And it turns out that they have a back wall that has these squares that have handles and they light up at different times. And like it lights up and it shows you a number on there and you're to go to your number and open the door and there's your food. So you actually never contact a human in the store, in the restaurant. And so to my point, you know, we are expecting either like, "Hey, we walk up and someone seats us and then someone comes and asks for a drink order and like to, you know, and then you can ask for the rest of your meal and then they bring it to you, or you go up to a counter and you pay and they give you food and you're done." And this was like just broke all those expectations, right? And so how do you, what are those expectations people have of your product or service, and how, what do they, and this goes actually to, you were mentioning designers earlier, where it's like, "Oh, we really want to be different and unique and special." And I'm not knocking that in the slightest. However, I'm saying that if we can match expectations to a certain level, we can build trust and gain confidence in what we're doing and, you know, have build a relationship where if all those things are so different, it feels so foreign that it's very hard for us to get used to it. And I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, bring back the flip phone, but I'm more saying that in some cases we want to start with their expectations and just, you know, move them gently from those to somewhere else. Like it would have been really nice in that kiosk restaurant that they had told me, "Hey, you're going to have, I could have a little video saying there's going to be a door that opens up and like show me my number on the door." Yeah. And then I could have gone, "Oh, that's what you're talking about." So anyway, I think that we have a zillion either implicit memories or just expectations like I talked about, or like imagine today, you know, you got up, you know, you woke up and you probably sort of like, you know, lumbered to the bathroom and brushed your teeth, for example. You probably don't remember like how you opened the door, or how you turned on the lights, or you know, that so many of those things are automatic in memory that we use. And so sometimes I want people to, who are the observers, designers, to see what all those things are that we don't even think about, and try to match some of those so that you use all of that working memory that we need with the seven things for the things I really need to do, and not the like, "Wait, there are doors at the back and there's no humans," you know, which is filling up my working memory. So I want it to be used for the right reasons.
Oh, that's so good. I was thinking about emotion too, and I love that you touch on that as well. Aaron Walter wrote a great book called Designing for Emotion, I think. And mm-hmm. that he touches on a lot of the memories that kind of happen when we make somebody feel something. But you, in your book, you show like kind of the other side of what that can mean, what the implications are of emotional decisions that are we're being maybe pressured to make while we're being overstimulated. Our brains are receiving a lot of cognitive load. Like you use some really compelling examples too. Like we touched on the car dealership, like how when you're negotiating for a car, the person you're talking to, the sales rep you're talking to, will go back when you make an offer. He'll go back into, or she'll go back into the manager's desk, right? It's like a fish tank, and you can see them in there. And I swear they're probably just talking about sports or that last night's score. They're not talking about your deal. They already know what the threshold is that they're willing to offer you. But they make you wait a long time, and you know you want the car. Right. If you're sitting there for over an hour, you obviously want the car. Then they come back after making you wait 10 minutes, maybe sometimes. And you're like feeling some anxiety. They come back and then they say, here's what we can do. And they have all these numbers on this page. And then it's like they're pressuring. There's a pressure right there to make a decision. But you're not ready. You're not emotionally ready. You're overstimulated. And like you use that example. You use the example of casinos. Like I've been in casinos. I totally made sense of why there's flashing lights everywhere. There's noise. It's just constant bombardment, and it's because it's a lot harder to make a sound decision in that environment. And so what are you going to do? Like, well, maybe I'll just play one more slot. Maybe I'll play one more. Maybe I'm about to hit the big one, you know? And so it's like all these decisions that there's psychology behind this, but it's sort of the dark side, right?
Yeah. So first of all, you're right on. Thank you for catching that in my book. And so in your casino, there's absolutely a reason why you can't see outside and they can't tell, you know, day and night and like, you know, a sense of time passing. And, you know, those are all because that's optimal for them and not for you. And
no clocks.
Right, exactly. And it's interesting. You know, I think the other side to that emotional thing that I want to speak to is, you know, I think I give the example in the book, but if I don't, let me, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, that emotional stuff, you know, I do internal systems for my company. And, you know, what you do with emotions, yeah, I don't have to worry about that stuff. We're good. Let me put you in the shoes of the person that I'm thinking of. So we were on Madison Avenue, literally, in New York City. And, you know, at a big ad agency, and we're helping a group that does, basically, it's kind of like a NASDAQ system of buying and selling for video ads. So if you're CNN, you could sell a space for a video ad. And in this case, we were in the advertisers and they were doing the buying on behalf of like GE or other people. And so, you know, the one person I met, I remember he was, you know, I don't know, like 24 maybe, you know, he's out of college and he got his first big sort of real job at an ad agency. It was like a cool place and it looked cool. And he's like, yeah, I'm on Madison Avenue. Yeah, I'm all that in a bag of chips. You know, this is cool. I can tell my parents still help me with my money because I make so little money here. But anyway, it's okay. Eventually I'm going to be a big star in this world. And, you know, it was like so much to his, you know, definition of who he was, right? And he thought it was really cool that he was one of the cool kids and really cool that he was an advertiser and so on. Anyway, so his job that day was to buy $8 million in advertising for, I think it literally was like dishwashers. And I think it might have been for GE. And and first of all, I don't know if you know, but if that's your job, you get in trouble if you don't spend $8 million that day. But secondly, he was like, oh my God, if I spend this wrong, right? I put it in totally the wrong place. I just blew $8 million in a day. I only make like 40 grand in a year. You know, like they're going to turf me and get another kid, you know, who's 24 to take my place. You know, so he was like completely stressed out about hitting the actual buy button. You know, he's like looking it all over and then like worried. And of course, this was an internal system. So it didn't give you a like, here's your checkout. Are you sure? It just said, you know, go. And so he was like frozen and panicked and like, oh my God, my whole self-definition of myself is going to be gone in an instant if I just hit the wrong button at the, you know, this drop down is not quite set right. And so, you know, in that case, completely internal system, also completely emotional. And so I think that it's actually really important to see, you know, see it for what it is in that way. And we see that both in the internal space and just, you know, public space every day, you know, who we define ourselves on as. I think I gave you, you know, in the book, the example, we worked with Capital One on, they were trying to figure out what their next credit card was going to be in a certain circumstance. And so, you know, we interviewed some people who were, in this case, it was like higher net worth kind of target audience. And, you know, we're just literally like, hey, what's in, you know, the first question, what's in your wallet? Oh, well, I have this card and this card and this card. I tend to use this one. Okay, cool. Well, what do you do on the weekends? Oh, well, you know, gosh, I used to go out a lot, but now I like there's soccer practice and this and this. And then, it, you know, a little further down, like, well, what do you plan to do, you know, later this year? Oh, wow. Well, you know, I used to go with my husband to this thing, but, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm just a mom, but, you know, I was a lawyer, my mom and my lawyer. Oh, my God, what am I? And, you know, by the end of this hour, we're just asking them questions. I think we interviewed 40 people and I had like 18 hugs and four people in tears, not because I was being cruel, because they were thinking about it, right? And they're like, what defines me? And it's really interesting how in everyday life, you can just ask people questions about themselves and not be in the slightest judgmental, but really hit on the core of what do they fear the most. So you were talking about actually Kahneman. So Kahneman actually used to work with a guy named Amos Tversky, and Tversky and Kahneman really caught that your things you would lose are so much more a bigger loss than, you know, $100 loss is a massive loss in comparison to a $100 win. And so so knowing what people find as what they could potentially lose is really important to think about as we're designing, because we want to make sure that they feel comfortable in that way. And you know, design the right way that they're making the right decisions too. To your point about the dark arts with user experience, you know, we can actually really help them to use that working memory the right ways and help them know that they are be safe in these cases. So a little bit of just asking questions and listening goes a long way with this kind of situation. And it's also, it doesn't take a psychologist. It's just, you know, I was literally like, what's in your wallet? What are you going to do next year? I like to call what I do advanced common sense, because, you know, it really is that.
What's in my wallet? Nothing. This driver has six children. That's compelling. And there's so many things that were swirling around my head. I was like getting lost, because you're sparking so many ideas here and thoughts. I was thinking about delight. There's two schools of thought here, and you sort of touched on it a little bit when I mentioned emotion. This isn't to stereotype, but typically IT type folks aren't as concerned about the emotional side of what they built or what they created. It's more about like, does this work? Does this have bugs? Does this meet the requirements? It's not, am I delighting the user? But then there's the other school of thought. And typically, you know, these two gangs, you know, there's a gang war sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. There's a fight about whether or not we should consider delight, or how much emphasis, and form over function, function over form, et cetera. Like, should we design for delight or not?
Yeah. Well, so actually, one of my favorite projects I did was for a group where, and I really encourage everyone to do this too, where, you know, if you're the researcher, user experience researcher, or take your pick on names, usability person or experience designer who has to go out and get out of the building, goob. Yeah. I want you to bring a ride along. So your ride along is one of the developers or one of the senior executives, and they come with you, and they, you know, so you get these crazy situations, right? So we were in Denver, and we wound up going, and you know, Denver, you know, Colorado's a little more relaxed on policies about marijuana and things. And so anyway, we wind up in some...
You're preaching to the choir, baby.
Some lower income housing, which is fair enough, no problem. But you know, so anyway, bottom line is we wound up sitting on the floor in this place that like totally smelled of like whatever was happening before we were there a moment ago. And it was actually the person we were interviewing was the teen. They were fine. It was the mom that was like baked. And the poor teen was like trying to make their way to college to get out of there. But I think the point was, you know, they saw, wow, when they use my app, they are, you know, in this environment, and they've got this old clunky phone, and the internet is kind of shaky here, and oh, you know, it's noisy. And, you know, so I think like actually experiencing that in real life helps those product owners or those senior executives like so much more be willing to, you know, work that little effort, you know. So product owners, great example. Mm-hmm. They got a deadline. I get bonused if I get this out the door by X. And, you know, if it's X plus 2 weeks, do I want to do that? And having that firsthand empathy is really important. I remember this one, and actually when we would report this back to the team, you know, we would discuss it over coffee or something afterwards, right, to make sure they were framing it right. But, and I would mention like, hey, did you notice them do this or whatever, just to make sure they were sort of, you know, caught everything. But I would get them to do the reporting back of what we found. So we had a developer, for example, say, listen, I know you guys think this John guy is like full crap, but seriously, this is a real problem over here. I don't care how many Fibonacci points it's going to take. We need to do this, guys. And so, and you know, there were men and women in the room, but you know, that's the way you said it. But I think the point is that, you know, they were willing to play ball, and it was just literally knowing. It wasn't necessarily that they're like, yeah, well, you know, I do my typing and we're good. You know, I think that everyone is in it for doing right, but they have to see it to really feel like, wow, I want to take this bull by the horns and fix it. Because it's not necessarily a problem in terms of requirements, but when you see it in action, you're like, oh, it is a real problem. And so that's where, absolutely, I try to get us doing the research. I try to get all the people doing it. More and more, we do video. We do things that are live so they can see it streamed somewhere. And I think a lot of those cases of doing video and having people show up in person, or having it where it's sort of live streamed so there are other people watching, can be super helpful.
Many UX professionals want a master's degree, but they don't want to move or pause their careers to do it. Thanks to UC Irvine's one-of-a-kind program, as a user experience professional, you can receive a world-class master's degree without quitting your job, commuting, or moving. UCI blends in-person learning with the flexibility of online distance education in a top-ranked one-year program. UCI's alumni become distinguished UX designers, researchers, and strategists all over the world. When you're ready to elevate your user experience or design career, UCI's master's program for HCI and design will give you just the lift you need. Learn more about this amazing program at userdefenders.com/UCI. That's userdefenders.com/UCI.
Actually, I can tell you it's helpful in a completely different context too. In more the golden days of this kind of work, we'd go to a focus group center, right? And there would be one way glass. And so you've got all the clients on the one side and obviously you and the person you're working with on the other. And actually I learned to check how soundproof is that glass. Not because of my participant, but because of the people on the other side being like, oh my God, it's control F shift F3. It's so obvious. You know, and so they, or we had these, you know, ridiculous things that would happen. Like, this one guy, I was like, we were in Long Island and doing these high net worth folks that had, you know, big, big accounts. And we, you know, we do all sorts of folks. We work with all sorts of people, but he was like, John, do you know how smart I am? And I was like, wow, you're, so of course I was like, oh God, where is this going in my head? But I couldn't say that out loud. So I said, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm sure you're very successful, obviously. And so, you know, I'm sure you're very impressive. You know, there's no doubt. He's like, well, John, you know, I'm really fucking smart. In the background, I could just hear everyone cracking up and behind the glass, right? And I had to, you know, totally straight face, like, wow, yes, of course. Yes. Oh, wow. This the other thing is you have to very much teach folks when you're doing this, and I think that actually I'm forgetting his name just for a moment, but there's one of the California researchers that's done great books on war stories,
Steve Portigal.
Yeah, exactly. He's a great guy, one of his things is you have to be completely neutral, and it's really interesting how you have to be agnostic to, like, you know, I had the guy, I personally am not into, I'm Canadian, so I'm not into guns as much. You know, he was like, hey, let me show you this gun. Oh, now let's go in the basement. I'll show you some more guns. I was like, great. So it's me and this guy and all his guns. Yeah, this is great. And he was just wanted to show that he was just really proud of his guns. And
he was proud of them.
Yeah.
Sure.
And, you know, or someone else was like, hey, check out the Hemi under this hood, you know, vroom, vroom. He had to like rev it up for me, and, you know, black smoke is coming out of the back, but you kind of roll with whatever that person is thinking about, because what is in their head? How are they representing the information? What are the decision points for them? What's emotional for them? You know, and you have to get in their world. So, you know, good training for this is you should ask all of your trainers for actually restaurant budget. And they'll be like, what? And because I want them to go people watching, they need to sit on outdoor cafes and like be like, what is that person thinking about right now? And, you know, you actually ask me the origin of kind of all this stuff. And I'll actually tell you a little of how I got into psychology in the first place is I distinctly remember, and I'm going to have to find this person someday. But, you know, in grade three, I looked over to the side, you know, and in class, you know, just ordinary grade three class. And there was a person named Valda, and that, you know, I didn't think she was, you know, hard to my eyes, but I remember distinctly thinking, like, what is in her head? What is she thinking about right now? What is, excites her? What, you know, what does she like to do? What, you know, and A, I realized, wow, that's how clueless I am. I like, I know literally nothing. And then B, you know, how interesting it is to think about what people are thinking about. And so I think from a very early age, I was sort of, you know, introspective about, you know, what am I thinking, but also, you know, what's in people's heads? And I think in part because I was so confused by their behavior, because I wasn't expecting it, that clearly they had something in their head I didn't. And so let's learn more about that. And so I wound up from there, you know, taking psychology as an undergraduate and, you know, seeing these different experiments and all these kind of things and just being really intrigued by what's in your brain and what goes on up there. And, you know, even this mind brain body problem, you know, of like, well, where is existence? I don't know. And, you know, nobody else knows either. But I think that there's lots of really interesting questions about, you know, what is the essence of a person? What are they, how are they thinking about a situation? How are they representing the information? What are the words they're using? What's the decision they think they should be making, even if it's not? There are all these pieces that you can do as a designer, do a great service by really understanding that audience and getting in their heads. Because, you know, there are lots of things that, well, we know we're not the users. But, you know, there are a lot of people that were like, well, I was a lawyer 30 years ago, and I know you walk down into the stacks and then you do this. And, you know, they weren't asking Siri a question about that and with a, you know, Google search result coming back. So I think that really seeing it today is really important. And even if you've done user research in the past, you know, we really have to keep doing it every, you know, 2-3 years to stay current on what's changing, because it's changing so much. Let me give you an example. So we asked a Gen Zer, well, you know, they mentioned, oh, yeah, well, you know, I one of our clients has a large search engine, you probably could imagine, and a top 5 technology firm. And anyway, they were looking at how Gen Z approaches, you know, getting information, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for them to do. And so this one person was like, yeah, we were in Atlanta at the time, and they were going to go to Houston to visit friends, and they were thinking about where to go for dinner. And so how do you think that they tried to find a restaurant? What do you think they did?
Google or Yelp?
Right. See, those are pretty good answers for us old timers. So what they did is they went to Pinterest. And you're like, Pint what? It turns out that it was, first of all, they were like, well, I really know how to use the hashtags there really well, and I can find things that other people have pinned, or I can go to Instagram and see pictures people have taken, and then I know these are people in my friend group or related to my friend group. They went to this restaurant. I can see pictures of the you know, scene in the restaurant. I can see pictures of the food. I know who they are, so I know what they like, and therefore I'm getting a very personalized recommendation. And it's like, wow, well, that made all kinds of sense, actually, now that you say it. But, you know, you and I didn't approach it the same way. And so, you know, they were like, well, you can't trust Yelp. This is full of, like, you know, fake recommendation, you know, reviews. Yeah. And so this was a way to steer away from that, in a way to get to very specifically, they wanted Tex-Mex because they're in Houston and they wanted this and, you know, this situation and not too expensive. And they knew that their friends would be about the same in terms of price range. And it made it, you know, so it was totally sensible, but it totally avoided these traditional tools. And so the question is for all of you listeners, what are the ways people are totally not using your systems the way you wanted them to, or unexpected value that your systems have that you didn't even know they have? And so it works both, you know, there's a positive and a negative to this. And so this is where I find my work so interesting, because we're always learning and we always discovering things that we didn't expect. So they say, well, John, you know, you've done this a bunch of times. Why don't you just like give us another one? And the answer is because, I can absolutely help you search the stacks in a musty basement of books, but that doesn't exist anymore. And so why don't we try what people are doing now? And so that's constantly evolving with, you know, voice and other things. We're finding it so interesting. And actually, I'll give you one more. With we haven't talked about wayfinding, and I'll give you a mix of wayfinding and emotion.
That's exactly where I was wanting to go next. I was going to ask you why you place so much emphasis on the importance of contextual interviews when gathering user data. You just answered that question. It's because we would never know Gen Z is looking at Pinterest for restaurants unless you were with them. You wouldn't know it. So you just answered that question. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there are hundreds of really interesting things we found. I mean, I think you can discover this too simply by, you know, hanging out near a bus stop with teenagers and watching them, or you have to go into, I guess, take your favorite, I guess, I don't know, one of those, you know, Chipotle kind of restaurants or you know, it depends on your neighborhood. It's, you know, In-N-Out Burger or a toast, right? But you're right. You're looking for the best avocado toast. But you'll watch them use Instagram or no, they would never use Facebook, so I'm not going to mention that. But right. Pinterest or Instagram or Snapchat, and it's like or YouTube, and it's like scroll, 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 tap, scroll, 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 tap.
Oh my gosh.
And one of the interesting things is
within seconds.
Is the reason why they're doing so much scrolling is A, because your visual perception is fast enough they can do it, but B, there is no good equivalent of visual search yet in the world. And this is like the next big thing. So if you want to be the Google killer, you know, or you want to be Google and be the next thing, either way, this is like, you know, it's really interesting time where search navigation are going to change with our video and audio and the ways we want to get that. Actually, I'll give you one more Gen Z example, because you may not be as familiar with this. You may be, and I'll be impressed. But if you're looking for, say, just the perfect, you know, smoky eye for makeup for you, it makes total sense that what they want is to see a picture of, like, the beginning and ending of someone doing that. They would like to see a super fast, like, here's all the things that are going to happen in this video, so I don't have to wait through 10 minutes to know if I'm going to get the right thing. And then I want to go on. So there are all these ways that you want to work with sound and visuals and cues that are quick, that make total sense, that don't exist today. So us in interface land, in app land, there are these great opportunities. So there's actually spray paint in Montreal that says too many causes without a rebel. And I feel like we have all these opportunities to seize the moment with great, great ways to make better experiences that for ways people now work and live. And my wayfinding example is actually one more Gen Z thing, where I remember coming in. My daughters are wonderful, and you know, the one I'm thinking about is particularly mild mannered, and she came in and was like stomping on the floor, like I could, you know, I was downstairs and could hear this boom, boom, boom upstairs, and went up and I was like, man, what, you know, did she get like hit by the bus, or did someone incredibly mean to her? And you know, she's like, I can't believe it, Dad, I can't believe it. And I was like, what, you know, what happened? And I'm like, you know, a horrible thing happened with, like, you know, someone being racially profiled, or a police officer, or I don't know what it was. Anyway, she comes out with it. Snapchat changed their interface. And so it turns out that the way that she had learned to go, you know, swipe, 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 or, you know, go this way for this was changed. And it was because the person who was the CEO was like, we need to make this more accessible to people who aren't just 14. And so we're going to make it more traditional interface. So, and that was because us as, you know, senior citizens who are over 25, it wasn't intuitive to us how you navigate in virtual space there. And I think this is another case that's a really interesting problem of how do you represent space virtually, whether it's on your Alexa or it's on that. And so in this case, they change the you know, interaction design such that space was no longer where it used to be. And so that's what made her furious. And if you Google this, you'll find all these things. Eventually, they put it back to the way it was, pretty much. But they had to backpedal and backpedal and backpedal, because it was like a like mission critical Snapchat ending, you know, situation where they tried to do right by here's traditional user interfaces, and because their audience was so used to this non-traditional one, it was too jarring.
Yep.
And so this is again where, like, let's try things in advance of getting it. And I don't know what kind of research they did and thought it was a good idea, but you know, it was really clear what strong visceral reaction this elicited. And that goes back to my, like, maybe you should make things consistent with the way people are thinking they would be. you know, and change it in other subtle ways, or change it gradually over time, which is ultimately what they did. And that's to keep up with those expectations and emotions and so on. So it was really interesting to hear, you know, all the things that could make her furious, right? It was like the, it was the way they represented virtual space on Snapchat. So there you go. That's my story for today on that one.
This episode is also made possible by something super cool, an alternative to the .com domain name. It's the, drumroll please, .design domain name. Try saying that 5 times fast. So if you're a designer, and I know you are, and you've thought of a sweet name for your website that just isn't available under .com, check out .design. Chances are the perfect domain name you want is waiting for you on a bearskin rug. Okay, maybe not the rug, but wouldn't that be great? Head to userdefenders.com/porkbun now and use coupon code DEFENDERS on the checkout page to get literally a free year of a .design domain name bundled with free email hosting, Whois privacy, and even SSL certs. Don't wait. Grab your .design domain name now before someone else does. Go to userdefenders.com/porkbun now and use coupon code DEFENDERS.
Yeah, that's. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you that. My question was going to be, what's the psychology behind why only millennials can effectively use Snapchat?
Oh, nice.
And so you touched on it, but it's like I guess you don't really. It almost seems like a happy accident, like, because the patterns that they established for this app are completely non-standard.
Yeah,
they're non-standard patterns. Mm-hmm. So, but the thing is that what they did by creating just these non-standard design patterns, they attracted an audience of young people who just figured it out and loved it. And I don't get it, because I'm not a Gen Z, I'm a Gen X, but I just don't understand, like, how does that happen? Like,
yeah.
Well, and how did just young people figure this out and get drawn to it?
Well, it's interesting, you know, and we all figured out, you know, that sort of iPhone or Android interface, you know, so we got there.
Yeah.
So actually, I was just busy telling you, well, you should keep things the way they were, son. And then here's an example that was really successful, but here's why. So let me try and tell you the difference. So in this case, what they did is they specifically were trying to get those dopamine receptors where you get people liking what you wanted. And actually, the reason for the interface style they had is that you can do it incredibly fast. So you can get through a lot of, and they had, you know, the one thing they did above all else is streaks. So I don't know if you know about this, but you have to have a streak. And once you get to the streak level, then you get this other filter and so on. So you get all these rewards. And so it's all about, they were masters at building rewards. And, so in that way, they did exceptionally well, and they made it super fast to do. And it was those two ingredients that made it work. And you know, in general, I think it's true that, you know, I remember as a kid, you know, realizing once I took apart my parents' stereo and realized that, oh, it's a little harder to put back together than take apart, that, you know, we as you know, young people are more willing to experiment and try new things. And so I think that's those three ingredients probably made that successful. So to the designers who are like, John, you just told me to keep everything the same, and now this totally turns stuff upside down and is super successful. Yes and no. So it was in the sense that a certain audience was successful with it, but not a broader audience. And that's why they tried so hard to bring the broader audience in. And then also, once you establish a pattern, we want a gradual transition out of that one, or else people will, you know, basically, there's mutiny on the bounty, so we want to be careful.
That's really great insight. When you try to please everybody, you please nobody, right? That's kind of the thing. It's like, and it's, we're in a situation right now where I work, we're trying to, we're facing something kind of similar in a way, where we're needing to redesign one of our apps, which is, it's kind of a game, but it's like really geared at fantasy sports people.
Ah, gotcha.
But we're trying, and that's a very special niche of people, and they get it. I'll be honest with you. I played the thing. I didn't get it. I gave up after one time, But now it's like we're trying to sort of kind of do the same thing where we're trying to bring in more of a broader audience, because we have people, like a lot of people signing up, like in a very small percentage are actually playing it more than once. So there, obviously there's a problem with that. I think maybe the problem is with our targeting. I think we're targeting the wrong folks is what's happening, because the people that are fantasy players love it and they're in it and they're constantly on it. So it's just funny. We have a similar challenge yet for older people.
Yep. I think you're right on. And, you know, you actually touched on this, like, don't design for everyone or you're designing for no one. You know, I remember one group that, you know, are a computer manufacturer of like calculators and printers you might think of. You know, I came in with them and they're like, so glad you're here, John. Okay, we've got 45 personas and we so don't know how to do this navigation. And I was like, absolutely right. And the first step is to throw away 40 of your personas and then we're going to get down to work. And so, and you're right that, you know, and this goes back to, you know, we make sure, one of the things we do too is to make sure we really, really understand what the business model is. So, you know, we're talking about being user defenders. And I think a piece to that is this much bigger, what makes our company money? What is it that, you know, who do we need to draw? Why are we trying to draw people to this? And understand that perspective and then say, okay, if that's the case, then here's our target audience and who we need to research and so on. Actually, another little, I don't know, not sneaky thing I do, but I think a really valuable thing I do that anyone can is I meet with each of the senior stakeholders individually. So I can hear them say, you know, Helen say, well, Bob's an idiot and Bob, you know, wants to do this. And of course we know that's wrong. We need to do this. And then I meet Bob and Bob's like, oh my God, Helen, I can't believe she wants to, she's got this idea that we want to do this. Of course that's wrong. But there's probably a commonality there, right? And so if we can help to, and so again, if you're the designers and you're being, you know, Bob shows up and is like, make it this way. And then he leaves and then Helen shows up and says, make it that way. You know, your design is going to be this weird mish, you know, I call it a Franken design, right? Where, you know, it's this mishmash of, I don't know, it's why you get to, gosh, there was this horrible minivan. I remember, I'll remember the name later, but anyway, it was like the example of why not to design by committee. But I think it really speaks to this, you know, let's be targeted to our audience and think like them. And if we can agree on who that target audience is, then we can say, okay, great. We, Helen and Bob, agreed to here's the target audience. Now let's go see what is in their heads and we'll try to make you money using that. And is that okay? And they'll both agree to that. So I think that we can find that commonality in our internally so that we can design for this, you know, the right target and not for whatever that senior stakeholder thinks.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, two examples of that design by committee. Like you mentioned the van, but I would say like the Ford Pinto is definitely one of those examples where they put the engine in the back and anytime there was impact, these things were exploding and catching fire.
Okay.
So that was a problem. And then the Winger Swiss Army knife.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Just Google that, defenders. Google Winger Swiss Army knife and you will see design by committee.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Everything but the kitchen sink is on that dang thing. So John, you have six minds of principles in your book here, the six minds process. And I have six special questions that I like to ask all of my guests at the end of the interview here. And so the first one is, what's your design superpower?
I think it would be that, you know, when we're seeing a future product when there is none. So like when we start to meet these target audience, I'm like, oh, they nobody has asked me for this, but what they really would, you know, what might be really valuable is this. And everyone's like, wait, what's John talking about? And I start writing stuff down. And so yeah, somehow I'm able to like, nice. to see that. And you know, we all get there, but, I find that comes pretty natural for me.
That's a great superpower. I love that. There's almost like a clairvoyance in there, like a product clairvoyance.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not perfect, but yeah, I get ideas. And so what I say is I get lots of ideas and, you know, 1 out of 10 is a good idea. And so yeah, we'll get there.
That's awesome. Well, you know, you can't get to the good idea until you get through the bad ones.
True.
Either. So I think that's a great superpower. And I may have biased your superhero name. I can't wait to hear it. what's your design kryptonite?
You know, I think it's and actually speaking to design, that last 5% of making the, you know, polishing the product or the results deck or whatever it is. You know, I love getting the big ideas out and I love getting us close, but that last polishing, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, I do it, but it's like, takes so much effort for me to get that last little bit out of me. So finishing the book, my editors at O'Reilly were very patient with me until they weren't, and then we finished it, and that's why we're here today.
I appreciate your vulnerability there. Like, I think that's a problem a lot of us have. And then there's the other psychological law of called Parkinson's law, which is, you know, tasks will expand the time allotted.
Absolutely.
So that's why timelines are really great. They're really important, but it's also a way for us to go, oh, I have more time for that, to get to that.
But I almost don't tell my team this, but I almost always give them less time than they really have so that, you know, they're like, this can't be done in that amount of time. I'm like, but we have to. So they focus on the core, like the most important things. Nice. And then like, great news, we have another 3 days. And they're like, I don't like you. And then they do great work. So yeah.
Yeah. 3 days for that last 5%.
Exactly.
That's awesome. No, I love that. That's great. And there's another use of anchoring, I think, too.
Hi, I'm Steve Portigal, user researcher and principal of Portigal Consulting. I fight for the users. You're listening to the User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
That's great. What would your UX superhero name be, John?
Yeah, so, you know, this is why I'm not in the naming business, but I came up with Envisionator because I think I can see what's around the corner there. So in the future, what we're going to need. So, you know, this visual search tool or something like that. So.
Oh, I like that. That's good. That's awesome. John, what's one habit that contributes to your success?
Yeah, you know, I think it came up before, but I think it really is thinking like stakeholders. So like taking the time to do user experience on your boss and your boss's boss. And so making sure we present things in a way that not just is like, here's the right thing we need to do, but here's the right thing we need to do in words you understand that you find compelling. And so I think that's so, that taking that time is so important. And I think that just naturally, I try really hard to think about our stakeholders.
Oh, that is really good. I like that a lot. I want to try to adopt that for myself, actually.
And I would argue that it's doing right by your users. So, you know, it's really, if we want to do right by the end audience, we know what they really, really, really deserve, then actually not just telling other people this is exactly what they deserve, but telling them this is what they deserve and this is why you want to do it. Or even this is why you want to do it. We'll figure out the details. We know what to do. You know, I think it's just, you know, you're ultimately doing user-centered design by being very thoughtful internally in your organization.
I like that. And, you know, John, I get this question quite a bit when people sign up for the mailing list. Mm-hmm. I always ask on the onboarding, I always say, hey, great to meet you. Thanks for signing up. Tell me one thing you're struggling with right now. I that's kind of one of my onboarding questions. And I can't tell you how many times I get this question that says, yeah, my biggest struggle right now is trying to get buy-in for UX from the higher ups, trying to get these folks to understand the value of UX. And I get that question a lot. And I actually, so much so that I actually have a canned like email signature that I can select to kind of try to help with that question. But I think one of the biggest, basically the answer to that question is what you just said. What one of your habits is thinking like a stakeholder. And that means thinking about business. Stakeholders are concerned with business primarily, which makes sense because that's why we have jobs.
Right.
If there's no business, there's no jobs for us to do. So I really emphasize, like, try to think about the business. And you said it earlier, John, think about what's the business model here. Mm-hmm. And figure out that what that is. And there's no better way to get yourself more exposed in the company than to meet with some of these stakeholders and some of these executives and say, I really want to know what our business model is, especially if you're newer to the company.
Right.
Like, I really want to know what our business model is so I can really help move the needle, to use a corporate speak, move the needle, right? And help kind of make some growth happen here. So I think really it's think like a stakeholder, defenders, like really understand the business aspect of what you're trying to do. And when you can incorporate that and even collect some data that supports your hypothesis, basis, you are going to be able to actually get UX more front and center in your organization.
And, you know, I've also been said, you know, people have, so it's true that we're a consulting company. We've worked with pretty big groups. So we get a little, and you know, it's like Dr. John coming in. So sometimes I get a little bit of a free pass in getting access to people who are more senior than other people might. That's true. But I think in many cases, though, you know, people don't realize how sneaky I am in getting to the senior executive. So just one quick story.
Tell us your tactics.
So one person, I happened to bump into the head of this big group at the lunchroom the one day, and I noticed, oh, it's about, you know, 20 after 12. Okay. Anyway, it turns out this dude goes to, and I'm going to tell you which company, but he shows up at the lunch bar with his security team, because he's that big a deal, at 12:20 every day. And so sure enough, what a coincidence. There I am with my wireframes and bump into him at the salad bar. And so I think my point, and then actually, what did he do? He then told the press, this is what we're going to do with these. And people are like, where did he get these wireframes? What are we like freaking out? But I think the point was that, you know, he was like, oh, that's so interesting that you're working on exactly the problem that I have told people that we're going to try to address. And so it was a little bit of breaking ranks, but I think the point is that you can get access to these folks if you're a little bit clever about it. And so I know that sometimes you are in Austin and they're in, you know, New York or whatever the case might be. But in other ways, there are ways to, you know, send something to your boss that's easy for them to share. Or, you know, we always make sure we have a like, here's the top four things you need to know about our research this week. And they're like fun things, right? And so they're easy to share and they go kind of internally viral because they're like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that. And so there are ways you can get to the, and eventually someone's like, I saw those things. You wrote those? Oh, okay, let's talk. And so there are ways to, you know, finagle your way up. So don't give up. They're interested. They want, and the last thing I'd say is that, do you want us to just design on a 3 cappuccino epiphany? Or do you want us to have evidence-driven decision-making and do the research? The choice is yours. You know, if you don't want risk, you know what to do. You know, you can make the choice, you know, how much you're willing to risk, you know, your career, all of our jobs, you know, it's cool. Go ahead. What do you want to do? And you know, they of course, you know, when you put it that way, they're like, well, of course I'll do the research. It's like, at, you know, 4% of our budget and you know, then my, you know, my wife's, you know, vacation she's been dreaming about is on the balance. So, or my husband's. And so, you know, thinking like that person and representing it in a way that's like, hey, do you like taking risks? And they're like, no, I'm in business. I like, you know, I follow the numbers, you know, I'm like, oh, well, what numbers do you have on this decision that we're making right now? And they're like, I don't have any numbers. I guess I'm just trusting you guys. Whoa, do you want to do that? Or do you want to like see if it works? Let's try that Snapchat interface and see what they think of it. So anyway, yeah, I think there are interesting ways you can do that.
Oh, so good. So many great takeaways in there, John. And I was thinking, I love how you said like, huh, what a coincidence that I happen to have my wireframes ready at 12:20 when I've noticed that that's when this person is in the cafe every day. Like, what a coincidence. Defenders, luck is where preparation meets opportunity.
That's right.
Bottom line, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a great example of that. And I just got to say, like, I've got a picture of me with MySpace Tom. I worked at MySpace in the good days in Beverly Hills, California from 2007-2009.
Awesome.
And I would see Tom around all the time around the office, you know, standing at the urinal next to him. And in fact, when I first started, we had blown up so much that I sat in a hallway. They had like computers just in the hallway there and right near Tom's office. And I remember one day Jessica Alba walked by to go to meet with him for like a movie promo or something, you know, just a normal day at MySpace. I remember I was in the cafe and they gave us a stipend of $50 a month, which was a neat little perk to use at the cafe. So I was just eating my Caesar salad one day and there's Tom coming into the cafe with somebody, an assistant or somebody like that. And I'm like, this is my chance. I'm going to get a picture. I'm going to get a picture with Tom. And look, there's a third person that can take our picture. So anyway, you reminded me, like, that's one of my favorite pictures of me standing there with Tom eating his grilled cheese sandwich. That was just a little nostalgia there that you reminded me of.
So those people are just humans like you and me too. Like people get worried about, oh, they're the like senior vice president. You know, they still right. have to go to the bathroom. And so exactly. not that I'm saying stalk them in the bathroom, but rather, you know, they're on LinkedIn. There's probably some news article. Like there's probably something where you can gather like, oh, they went to University of Honolulu. They probably like surfing, you know, like, so there are a few little right. tidbits where you can just get a little like, where they're like, hey, how did you know that about me? And anything related to them suddenly is the right answer. So to even asking the right question about things they're interested in and letting them, the less you talk and the more they talk, the more they think that you are full of good ideas because the ideas actually come out of them and they have this source monitoring error where they think it came out of you. And so so let them talk. But there you go.
So good. So good, man. So in addition to your wonderful book, Designed for How People Think, I want to ask you if you could recommend, because I'm going to recommend that book highly, Defenders, pick it up. It's really great. And just this conversation is just a glimpse of all of the depth that's in there. So I highly recommend picking it up. There'll be a link in the show notes. But John, I want to ask you, what would you recommend if you could recommend one book to our listeners and why?
Because you mentioned Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Dan Kahneman.
Yeah.
He does a great job at talking. So he is a, you know, very scientific nerd, and yet he writes beautifully for mere mortals. So I think that's a great book. I'm going to give you, but you mentioned it. So I'm going to use that for, I'm going to give you a different one. So I want you user defenders to think big. So there's a book called Digital Transformation by Lindsay Herbert, and you probably never heard of it, and that's my point. So you went back to MySpace. We all user defenders used to be like, hey, do you put the okay on the right or the cancel on the left or the other way around? And then later we got to, hey, can you design this screen for me? And then, hey, can you figure out the navigation of this website? And then, hey, can you help us with this customer experience? And my point is that we're getting to, and you were talking about talking to senior executives and our value. I believe our value is at the highest level of making decisions about how we should organize our company. So we are increasingly being asked, wow, we have all these insurance products from this group we bought at this giant corporation. How do we make an experience for those end audience, but also make it so our senior executives can represent what's happening in all these divisions we just bought? And so we're helping to redesign how this organization lives at that like big, big, big design, you know, not just service design or service design blueprint. And so I want you to just never think too small. I want you to think big about what you can do as designers, because we're being asked increasingly to design the system and not just the experience. And so I definitely, my book, Design for How People Think, it was thinking about individual experiences at that level. But I think we can really think at that bigger level. And when you're done my book, and thank you so much for mentioning it, I'd love you to pick up Absolutely. Digital Transformation by Lindsay Herbert. It's not anything where you'll be super shocked, but it's a nice way to put it all together. I found it super valuable when we started getting asked questions at that level of what product should we offer? How should we organize our company? How many divisions should we have? How do we get them all to talk to one another? How do we represent the numbers? How do we get people to input the numbers? How do we get people to present the same thing across our company? And it's really, they're fascinating questions. And I think those are questions designers have never got to chew on and that we're getting. So I want you to be ready.
Wow, that's amazing. I've heard of a lot of design books. I have not heard of that one. So your assumption was correct. What is your best advice for aspiring UX superheroes?
I kind of blurted it out just now in saying thinking big. But I think the point there is we are all learning. You know, some people are like, oh, well, you know, John, you can do this because you've got all this years of experience, blah, blah, blah. No, I mean, I'm desperately learning as fast as you are too. And so, first of all, we should keep learning. But second of all, there is no expert in what we do. Everything is so new that we are all equally expert. And granted, I won't try to bill that way, but never feel there's this notion of you know, being afraid to do it because I haven't got the training or I haven't got the whatever. And I just want you to know that we are all trying to figure this out just in the same way that we're all trying to figure out how to live as humans. And so don't ever treat yourself as, oh, I shouldn't ask that question because I don't have the knowledge, practice, da-da-da. I want you to take a shot. Not that you might not have to learn a ton and buy a bunch of books and see a bunch of videos, but don't be afraid to tackle the challenging problem even though you're quote-unquote more junior, because we're all just as junior on exactly that problem. So you are as good as anyone else at solving that problem.
Ah, so great. I love it, John. I love it. We are all pioneers. That's Sophia Prater told me that when we were talking recently. We're all pioneers. We're all creating this as we go. There's no right, quote unquote, right way to do this. It's very contextual. This work is very contextual. Mm-hmm. And you have great examples again in your book about some of the stuff you would have never ever learned unless you were there, unless you were in front of the people using this thing you're designing for. And, you know, watching their eyes move, watching their context of what they're doing when they're being asked to do something. And like, there's just so much to this. So I love it, John. Thank you so much again for writing this great book. Thanks, O'Reilly, for publishing it. And John, thanks for your time here today. This has been incredible. Dr. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, I defy you to read any personal growth and psychology book without his name being mentioned in the pop sci genre. I defy you. But he mentions, and he studied greatly, the study of what he calls flow. And I just feel like this whole conversation, like this has been a flowing conversation. And the time has just gone by. It's just been amazing. I've learned a ton. So I just want to thank you so much, John, for your time and for your generosity. And last but not least, I want to say, as always, fight on, my friend. Out of all the value bombs Dr. John dropped on us today, my biggest takeaway was around the critical nature of user research. In fact, that's really the basis of his new book, Design for How People Think. If we don't know our users and make the time and investment to do so, we can't possibly meet them where they are and, consequently, take them to that better place we want and need them to go. Jerry McGovern tweeted recently, "The amount of UX people I meet who don't regularly do user research is disturbing. In fact, in many organizations, the digital team rarely interacts with customers." He then went on to say, "Is the word research wrong? Should we start calling research evidence? Would that help businesses invest more in user research and take user researchers more seriously?" He makes some very compelling points. We all need to proverbially goob a little more. And if you don't know what that acronym means, then you need to be a good researcher and go back and re-listen to the parts you skipped. I'm just kidding. It means get out of the building. This work is far too important, and releasing the wrong thing for the wrong people, even the right thing for the wrong people, is too costly of a mistake to make. If your company thinks research is expensive, wait till they see how expensive building the wrong thing is. I know it can be an uphill battle, but keep managing up on this and start influencing with small experiments that use research as the basis for proving your hypothesis. There's nothing more convincing than showing leadership short edited videos of actual users struggling with their product. Definitely pick up John's book. I have an Amazon affiliate link in the show notes at userdefenders.com/067 that if you use it to buy John's book, you'll be helping UD at no additional cost to you. Again, check out the show notes at userdefenders.com/067, which include not only the link to buy John's book, but Eli Jorgensen's awesome superhero art, mention links, and even a transcript for our hearing impaired defenders. Speaking of his great book, John was kind enough to offer a few to me to give away. Here's how I'm going to do this. Simply leave a rating and review on iTunes, take a screenshot of it, and email that to userdefenders@gmail.com by October 23rd. I'll randomly select the winners and personally mail John's great book out to you. Do that simply by going to userdefenders.com/review, and or in iTunes, type UX or UX design, and User Defender shows up pretty close to the top. So thanks again so much. Tweet your takeaways, Defenders. I'm at User Defenders and John is at John Whalen. Well, I also want to invite you to check out User Defenders community for free for 7 days at community.userdefenders.com. userdefenders.com. There's just some amazing human beings there, designers, developers, web designers, researchers, all sorts of folks in there meeting for the same reason, to see how we can all encourage and inspire one another, make each other better, and also even change the world through good design. So check it out, community.userdefenders.com. I'd love to connect and engage with you there. I want to thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork and Darren Goldsmith for the sensational show notes. Find those at userdefenders.com/067. I also want to thank sponsors UCI, their Masters in HCI program. It's super compelling to be able to do that. You can go to userdefenders.com/UCI to check that out. And also Porkbun, get your own .design domain name, userdefenders.com/porkbun. In 2 weeks, I have the one and only Braden Kowitz, who is of Google Ventures fame and also a co-author of the Sprint book that many of us have been impacted by. If not read it, then we certainly know somebody who is doing design sprints thanks to this book. So this was a really great conversation. Braden is a deep well, and I really enjoyed it. This one was super deep. So definitely tune in. Make sure you subscribe too at userdefenders.com/subscribe to automatically receive this episode and future ones on your podcast playing device. Thank you so much for listening, dear defenders. I appreciate you more than I can say with words. Your encouragements on Twitter, your emails, telling other friends about the show, it means a lot to me and it makes a big difference. So thank you so much. And last but not least, I just want to say, as always, fight on, my friends.